This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also grab off our website over at progressive.org. Today, I'm delighted to have in the studio with me Brian Gilmore. He's a poet and a public interest lawyer who writes regularly for our affiliate, the Progressive Media Project. He's teaching law as a clinical law professor at Michigan State right now, and he's the author of two books of poetry, Elvis Presley is Alive and Well and Living in Harlem, and also Jungle Nights and Soda Fountain Rags. Love that title. Brian Gilmore, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Welcome. Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot for having me.
Well, it's great to have you right here in the studio. And, you know, I've been editing your copy for a long time. I've seen you a couple times and talked to you, but it's nice to see you again.
Yeah.
Usually I just see you with the words in front of me on a piece of white paper and me with my purple editing pen in my hand. So it's good to have you in the flesh.
Right. Yeah.
Tell me and tell our listener who's in her car or in his office or at home a little bit about yourself, where you grew up.
I grew up in Washington, D.C., northeast uptown, black neighborhood. I went to Frostburg State College. It's in the mountains of western Maryland. I did go to Howard University, the capstone, for a semester. But, you know, I sort of felt the need to get out and you know, I don't know, soul searching, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
And went to law school there as well. I went to the David A. Clark School of Law, the public interest law school. But, you know, I'm a Washington, D.C. kid, 100%, you know, political town. But I'm from the real D.C. where the people live, so to speak, not the federal city.
Mm-hmm. And did you always want to be a lawyer?
I can't say that, but I always wanted to communicate and use communication to get ideas across to people and to maybe come up with some change. I wanted to help people. My father was a civil servant, personnel person in the city, and he always helped people get jobs, and I always was highly impressed with that. So I knew I wanted to do something like that. I felt like I should do something because I saw what he did every day, 20, 30 years, helping people find a job.
Is he still around?
No, my father passed 2001. So,
well, that's hard, though. It's always hard losing your dad, isn't it?
Yeah, I think about him every day. I always riding around talking, having a conversation with him.
Is he still giving you advice?
Right, yeah. No doubt about that.
And poetry. Tell me how you got interested in poetry.
Well, I mean, I was always big. I went to a school called Archbishop Carroll High School, and it was, you know, it was a big liberal arts school. So, and in my home, literature was a big deal as well. But when I got to college, the big thing was the South Africa movement, divestment. I was a student at the time, and Reagan, the constructive engagement. Am I saying that right? Constructive engagement. That was the big thing, and I sort of became involved in that and began writing poetry, sort of surrounding the ideas around South Africa, Reagan, and the economy. People in cheese lines, and I began to write poetry along that line. It wasn't very good, but when I got back to the city from school, I knew I wanted to write, and poetry was just one thing that I got into. I mean, it was other kinds of writings, but poetry was definitely one I slipped right into.
And was this at the beginning of the poetry slam scene, or this was a little before that, wasn't it?
This was probably like right before that, so I came up more of the people, you know, write, you know, they was like, we want to be poets. We want to, you know, sort of the old backwards kind of way, so to speak, I would say. I don't want to talk bad about it. And the slam scene came on, the spoken word scene, sort of energized what we were already doing. And it was kind of cool for those two to come together. And I came up in that, too. Although I was never a slammer. I was more, you know, I was doing readings around the country and stuff like that. But I was never a slam poet per se. I never even entered a slam.
Do you have a poem you'd want to read for us?
Yeah, I'll read this poem called Mask, and it's dedicated to Paul Laurence Dunbar, and it's because of Paul Laurence Dunbar's poem, We Wear the Mask. So this is Mask, and it was inspired by Jan Brewer shaking her finger at Obama, and then traffic stops. Jan Brewer, governor, shaking her finger at us, asking for birth certificate 3 o'clock roadblock, barbershop joke, street corner chatter, time passing, since making of friends in the joint, save us programs, Time Magazine photo of running back accused of murder. And I'm just back from Louisiana picking up a truck my father-in-law left for us. Got pulled over twice by the police in Michigan for a broken headlight. Papa was too sick to replace the light. I'm telling the police that this is Papa's truck, and he gave this truck to us on his deathbed. Cancer got him on the ropes like Foreman on Ali, and he can't rope a dope. I am cool with the first cop. He sends me on my way, gives me advice about car maintenance. 10 minutes later, pulled over again. Well-dressed member of the same police crew, and I'm thinking, don't y'all talk. Don't y'all have them things I once got for Christmas, where I could talk to one of my friends in the alley, and I was out front in the street. He is a black cop, and he wants to see my papers and wants to know if I got guns, drugs, or other weapons in the car, and wants to know who is the young girl in the front seat, even though it is my 13-year-old daughter, who I just picked up from Russian ballerina practice. I laugh. Richard Pryor taught me well. Perhaps I should have stepped out the car and started singing loud and true like Burt Williams or Ben Vereen, 1981, Cork Face, Ronald Reagan grinning, Grinch Who Stole Christmas, 1912. Stars aligned again, the Titanic must be sinking. My 13-year-old read a poem in class this year. I told her I read that same poem in class when I was in third grade. Mrs. Lewis, Jesse LaSalle Elementary, this is why she wanted to read it. We Wear the Masks, Paul Lawrence Dunbar. We all know this one. Shake your finger, sport that old pair of shoes. Try to squeeze into that tight dress with ruffles out of place. Neither will get you very far these days. It is easy to see, even with broken headlights. Little black girls are learning to dance like Baryshnikov. The rest of us are slowly washing the cork off our faces.
That's Brian Gilmore reading a poem about being pulled over a couple times within 10 minutes in Michigan. Right. What did your daughter make of that experience?
Well, my daughter immediately said, why are they asking you for drugs? Do you have drugs or guns in the car? She was outraged that they would say, why are they asking you for, do you have drugs or guns in the car?
And how'd you explain that to her, that whole deal to her?
I mean, it was quite difficult to tell the truth. It was just like when I saw, I was in the store with her and she saw these tabloids that had Obama saying, Obama born in Kenya, and it was these newspapers. She asked that same question. It's quite difficult, you know, with the young people today. I mean, they have an entirely different view of society than I do, so to speak. I mean, some of it's because I'm older, but also because, I mean, they have a sense of optimism that you know, you don't see, that you probably didn't see, and maybe the young people that came sort of after me, so to speak.
And so they think this is odd or a relic of an ancient past or something?
Right. This is real strange to them. You know what I mean? It's real strange to them that people treat people like that because they are black, or they treat them because of their differences and things like that. It's just very, very strange to me. And I notice my 13-year-old now really locks in when she hears these things, because she's very impressionable now. She wants to know. Because, I mean, she's heard loosely the history, but her experience has been mostly pretty positive. Cosmopolitan, multicultural society. You know what I mean? She's like, things are good. Things can be good. I should say it like that.
What was your first brush with racism, where as a kid it interfered with you or hit you on the head?
Well, with racism, like I grew up in D.C. and my neighborhood was all black. And for a while I used to joke to people, say we didn't even know white people even existed except in magazines. But, you know, when I went away to camp one time and I wrote a poem about it, you know, in my first book, and it's all, we went in a store in Delaware and the shopkeepers just kept coming to us and said, stop trying to steal. What are y'all doing? What are you taking? And I was like, what is he talking about? I have money. I mean, my parents gave me money, right? And he kept saying, and then, you know, later on, our counselors explained to us that what was going on. And that's when it first struck me that they were doing them because we were black kids and they thought we were all thieves, that kind of thing. So that's the first one that stuck out of my mind where I just said, man, somebody did something to me because I was a young black kid.
And how have we moved in this country over the last, and I don't even know how old you are, but several decades on this? I mean, here we have Barack Obama's president running for re-election, and yet there's still a lot of racism in the country. How do you take its temperature?
I think there's no doubt that the Jim Crow structure was dismantled, and it's gone, so to speak. The legal racism has been killed. But I think the thing that hasn't been killed is customs, traditions, people's beliefs. I always say it like this. I tell my friends, especially white friends, I say America thought that racism was a flat tire. And they could just change it. It's not. Racism is more like it was a pond and it was full of toxic waste. And they have to clean that pond. That pond is still, we're still in that pond, even though the laws have been changed and people can do what they want to do in society. But the customs and attitudes remain because they have refused to take the approach of, you know, we really have to change attitudes. And it might be a slow process. Might just be slow. America might just want to go slow.
Mm-hmm.
And
so
that might be why they want to take that approach. But it's not racism is not a flat tire. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? That's the way I look at it.
The toxic pond might get into the groundwater too, or there may be mosquitoes breeding
right,
in the toxic pond.
That's kind of like,
you can play with that a little
bit. It's a crazy metaphor, but that's kind of like how I look at it.
And then there's all this resegregation in schools too,
right,
which is really dramatic.
Right. And I think that's a product of the fact that we changed the tire, but it's still a toxic situation that will continue to manifest itself. You got to change attitudes. What about the curriculums of schools? I mean, for hundreds of years, I mean, white people were told that black people were subhuman or something. How do you erase that? I mean, you have to try to erase that.
Now, you're teaching law school at Michigan State. You're doing a housing clinic there. What is the housing situation like that you're dealing with?
Hey, I mean, in Michigan, and I'm pretty sure across the country, it's pretty tough out there. Foreclosures are extremely high, and it's manifesting itself in the rental market as well as the sales market. And I think the mistake that was made, and, you know, this is the thing that's not a part of, it's not a part of the election discussion, the campaigns. I mean, the response to it, was just, we appreciate the response, but it's just not been effective at really, really getting to the root of eradicating the problem of stopping the foreclosure, the loss of value, the loss of wealth, communities falling apart across the country because these properties go by the wayside. Michigan, as you know, was hard hit, especially the counties around Detroit. Wayne County was hammered. Where I am in East Lansing, that county, Ingham County, was hammered. Some other counties made out a little bit better, but Michigan, I think Michigan is still like seventh on the list or something like that. Once it was third or fourth. Really bad. I mean, if breaks apart the community, I think they should have just decided from the start, we're just going to wipe this out from the start. And they needed to just decide how they were going to pay for it. Instead, it's been a piecemeal approach. This program here, help a few people here, sue some bankers here. They pay their way out. Everybody moves on. But the problem remains. People still remain in bad mortgages.
Well, it seemed to me that that this piecemeal approach by Obama to the housing crisis just was so inadequate. And that
right,
what he could have done at least one or two things, probably more. And this is your field of expertise, not mine, Brian Gilmore. So you probably have other ideas. But it seemed to me when he had those bankers, on their last gasping breaths that he could have said, if you want the $700 billion and the $1 trillion in guarantees, have a moratorium on foreclosure for a year or two,
which is what
Hillary Clinton was talking about when she ran last time.
Right. That's exactly right.
He could have said, everybody's mortgage is going to be reduced by 30%. You got to reduce everybody's mortgage that you hold. And, there are 60 million people that these big banks hold mortgages for. And if everybody's mortgage got reduced, everybody would have been better off.
That's exactly right. I think at that time, the bankers even admit that he could have done pretty much anything. We had no leverage whatsoever. But they didn't make some of their best programs that they've touted They didn't make them. They made them voluntary. Even the programs that are inadequate, if they would have been made like you have to do this program, they would have worked far better. They would have. And in the 30s, Michigan had a moratorium. Michigan had a foreclosure moratorium in the 30s. It was successful. There's writings about that. It was a great article in the Wayne State Law Review like 2 years ago about the Michigan State moratorium that actually helped stop the bleeding. And then everybody, we were able to get everything together. Instead, this has been, it's just been the same old, same old. It's been a little here and there. Even the latest settlement that they bragged about, I mean, the people who are the worst off don't get that much money out of it. It's a couple thousand dollars max that you can get out of that program.
And that's not enough to help people who are facing foreclosure.
Right. I mean, in another one you mentioned about the principal reduction, finally, way into this, they have a small principal reduction program. That should have been from the start.
With the government funded
loans.
Everybody
knew what they were dealing with. They were dealing with overvalued. The houses had been overvalued by appraisers. Everything would have been, everybody was part of it. So I think the question was just, how do we just pay for this? And just get this over with now instead of dragging this out for years and years.
Yeah, it's been a real problem, and it's dragged down not only local economies in East Lansing and Detroit, it's dragged down the whole national economy.
Right.
And I think we'd be a lot better off right now. I just don't know why Obama didn't do more in that meeting with the bankers. I read a book on it, he brought the bankers in, and they thought he was going to spank them and order them to do something like we've been talking about here. And instead he said, I'm on your side. It was just crazy.
Oh,
I'm speaking with Brian Gilmore. He's a public interest lawyer and clinical law professor at Michigan State, puts on a housing clinic there. He's also a poet, and he writes op-ed commentaries pretty regularly now for years and years for the Progressive Media Project, which is our affiliate over at the Progressive Magazine. You're listening to Progressive Radio. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive. Tell me about a little bit more about Michigan, because I think what I heard a lot about Michigan over the last couple of years, and what the listener probably heard too, was about this emergency management law that the governor had railroaded through and allows the governor to kick out the mayor or kick out the county board president and appoint someone from the private sector if he wants to run the show, which seems so undemocratic.
Right. Yeah, they've had one emergency manager law for many years, but Snyder took it to another level, so to speak. So now, as I understand, the law is on up for a vote in November in Michigan. And surprisingly, the last poll I checked in Detroit Free Press, it is awfully close. And in fact, the repeal is winning right now. It's like at about 48%, so to speak, for repeal, which is amazing. In that, you figure all this corporate money and things like that, this sort of grassroots effort is actually working. And a lot of cities are sort of ready for it to end, so to speak. They're ready for, Michigan was doing really, really bad. It's still having a lot of problems, but they're ready to move on. Especially, you have these school districts down by Detroit. And it's like two school districts that are basically being privatized using this law. Because there's the emergency manager who's been put in charge of the school system has decided that, oh, we'll go with charter schools or something like that. So a lot of these jurisdictions are like, it's time for us to move on. And it looked like there's a chance that the repeal might go through. And I think the repeal should go through. I think it's time for the governments to just get back local control and get back and move forward with what they need to do. They need the governor's help, but they don't need the governor's control.
And from a legal perspective, you're a lawyer. How is it possibly legal to just take people's right to self-representation away?
Well, there was a couple court cases challenged the law and on various grounds, and they actually won. They're saying exactly what you're saying under those kind of theories, saying that the law, the law has some democratic problems in terms of, one man, one vote kind of thing. Some people challenge it on different grounds, the fact that they didn't follow procedure, but they've been highly successful in drawing attention to this law and challenging it and things like that. And I think that will continue. I think it's very unpopular in certain circles, but in other circles, they like it. But most people feel like a local jurisdiction should be able to say what they have say over their affairs. They do need the state's assistance, financial assistance, that kind of thing. But they, what they mostly need is control, because they know their area better than anybody else.
Mm-hmm. Brian Gilmore, you mentioned a second ago this move toward privatizing schools, and it's happening in one state after another. And we saw the issue with the Chicago teachers strike, where that was one of the subjects that came up. Also charter schools, and then there's the whole question of teaching to the test and this crazy mania for test taking in our schools. How do you see this issue of public education going?
Yeah, I think, it sort of takes me back to, where I am now in Michigan. There's a guy up there who does commentary. I don't know if you heard of this guy. It's Jack Lessenberry. And he does commentary, and he wrote a piece about the Detroit districts that are sort of going private. And he basically said what I think everybody feels. Everybody has opinions about public and private and things like that, but most people would say, school is not a business. The education of your kids is not a for-profit business. They have to get away from that idea. And then if you want to have some private components, you work into the school system to help out. I mean, I think people are willing to listen to that, but they're not willing to say we need to turn a profit while we're educating our children, turn it into a for-profit business. That's craziness. And he wrote a really good piece about it. And I just, as I listened to it, I said, that's exactly the way people feel about it. He was saying, like, why are you all doing this? Of course, we want public schools to work, but we definitely don't want something where we'll just turn it into a for-profit business. That's definitely completely out. And I think that's where I stand on it, where I don't think education should be approached like that. It can't be.
There's just huge private money and private right-wing foundation money behind this effort that's going on. We've had a fight here in Wisconsin, and there are fights all over the country on this. This is a really serious issue. It's going to be with us for a while. And I don't think, at the national level, President Obama has been that great on this either, because Race to the Top is just like No Child Left Behind. And so we're just continuing on this thing. What's your reaction to this kind of demonizing of teachers, or certainly demonizing of teachers' unions? What's your take on it?
All right, I think that, like I said, my parents were civil servants, so, support
the union members.
What's that?
They were in unions?
My father was a personnel guy, so, my familiarity with unions is it's big. I mean, I completely support unions. I think what has been lost here is everybody has to realize we're all in this together, and I think that's what has been lost in this whole push for privatization. There's no care about the consequences of what they're doing, kind of thing. I even think that the teachers are completely willing to discuss things and work things out, but I think what it has turned into, if you're in a union, it's bad. Collectivism, I hate to get ideological, right? It seems to be a complete hatred for anything collective anymore.
Anything
collective is bad, so to speak. But, what about the entire collective? We're all a collective, so to speak, and it's almost like they're out of it. They're out, and they've opted out of it, and the rest of you all, I don't even want to get into that, but it's like an ideological thing. Where if you're in a union, it's bad. I was reading about Galbraith was talking about that at one point unions were like 25%. Now, what is it now, 7?
Yeah, I think in the 50s it was even in the 30s, right. 35%, right. 38%
so unionized workforce. To say that unions have enormous power is a joke, so to speak. Right. I mean, in terms of they don't have enormous power. But I think they are interested in the common good, and I think that's what has been lost.
Yeah, I mean, if the Republicans succeed in demonizing unions and corporations succeed in crushing unions, mostly by largely by illegal right. tactics, and then, they get their way with shrinking government, what's going to stand between the consumer and the worker right. and the corporation that's exploiting the consumer and the worker, or, polluting the land or polluting the air, or just destroying the climate? I mean, we need some checks on these corporations, right. but you've got this idea coming out of Paul Ryan and Mitt Romney that, right. Free enterprise system will solve everything and government can solve nothing.
Well, if that were true, because they've had their go of it. I think it was interesting. I'm reading The Affluent Society by Galbraith again, and he made this really, really good point. I think sort of goes with what you're saying is, he said if it was true that trickle down, that approach, privatize everything, big tax breaks. If that model worked, he said Latin America would have boomed during, would have boomed, because that's what, that was their model. He was like, a few people at the top had all the money and it would have trickled down to the masses. He said, but Latin America was a scene of complete poverty for centuries now. You know what I mean? He was like, the model is that that does not work. There's no record of that ever working.
And actually, it's booming now, years after his death, when they've taken a more socialist approach down in Latin America.
Right. That's kind of like what he was saying. He said, that model worked. Then Latin America would be the perfect evidence of it. And he said, but there's no evidence of it. They gave people at the top, a few at the top, all the money, so to speak, and they just kept it. You know what I mean? He said, there's no record of, even investment being done. There's no pattern of this ever happening that he can even think of. This is in The Affluent Society, which is one of the better books, I think, on analyzing, you know, the American economy over the decades and things like that.
How do you see the election going here between Obama and Romney?
You know, it's hard to say. I mean, Romney is a horrible candidate. He's horrible. He has a lot of money behind him, and the economy is, you know, it's about to probably take another downturn, so to speak. The New York numbers on manufacturing were horrible just this past month. So, I mean, as bad as Romney is, I think he's still in this race with Obama because the economy is tanking. And because even though he says it's about this 40%, 47%, I mean, it's like 40, 45% they're going to vote for Romney no matter what. Even if Romney said, if I get elected, I'm going to throw all of you all in a volcano, they probably still would vote for him because they don't want to vote for Obama. It's a complete anti-Obama vote, anti-Democrat vote.
I remember a poll with Michelle Bachmann as the Republican nominee. She was still getting 44, 45%.
That's what I mean. I mean, it's like 40, 45% that are going to vote for the other side anyway. But he's a terrible candidate. Now he's shifting hard to the right. So, I mean, generally that doesn't work, but we'll see. You don't know what'll happen. I mean, like I said, I was telling you when we were walking over here, if you listen to the radio on the other side, they're not looking at it like it's so bad. They think the race is close. I think the race is close. I think it's only down to a few states, though. Probably Ohio, Florida, Virginia, Nevada, Colorado. I think that's it.
How much do you think he's going to play the race card or the welfare card?
I think they're going to play the race card. I think that's why he shifted right. I think they're going to play that hard. I think they're not going to go like McCain. McCain, with his flaws and everything, was still a statesman, so to speak. He was not going to go. He would not want to be elected using hatred. I think that this time they're going to play the race card. I think they're going to play whatever card they can, the pro-terrorist card, the apologist card. I think that's going to happen. I mean, I think that's just how it is. I mean, at this stage of the game.
Well, they may be that desperate and that ugly, but it would be a sad turn for American politics if they took that route. But I think you may be right on that. Brian Gilmore, unfortunately, we're out of time. Brian Gilmore has been my guest today on Progressive Radio. He's a clinical law professor at Michigan State. He's also a poet. His last book was Jungle Nights and Soda Fountain Rags. Brian Gilmore, thanks so much for being my guest today.
Thank you.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by MUFA. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.